Autism Science Foundation, a not-for-profit organization that funds autism research and serves to increase awareness of autism spectrum disorders and the needs of individuals and families affected by autism. Allison has a daughter with autism and is the legal guardian of her adult brother with autism. Since 2007, she has served on the National Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee, which is charged with writing a strategic plan to guide federal spending for autism research. Allison is a graduated magna cum laude from Yale University with a BA in economics and has an MBA from Harvard Business School. Last year at NIC, she presented the new CASE, acronym CASE, model, which is a program for communicating with vaccine-hesitant parents, and she's here today to give us an update. Please welcome Allison.
Thank you. This is always the moment of truth, when you see if your slides are here or if you're just going to wing it. What do you know? Okay. So this weekend, I had a chance to talk to a friend of mine from high school who I haven't seen in several years. She's completely not in the healthcare community. She teaches aerobics. She has three boys, all immunized. And she said to me, why is an autism person speaking at an immunization conference? And I said, wow, where have you been? But really, that is the goal, I think, to which I aspire. I love coming to this conference every year. I would love to keep coming, but at some point, I really hope that we are not going to be talking about autism at vaccine conferences. I think many of us hoped we would be at that point already, but that's certainly, I think, a goal. One of my goals will be to obsolete myself. But we are still here talking about autism because autism is still the number one concern raised by parents when among vaccine-hesitant parents. So it's still very important for those of you who are speaking one-to-one with parents to know what's going on in the autism community so that we can provide good information to them in response to their concerns. Autism spectrum disorders, when we talk about autism, we're really talking about a group of disorders, including classic autism, PDD-NOS, which is pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, Asperger syndrome, which some people sometimes refer to as a higher functioning type of autism, where the individuals are much more verbal, have an average or above average IQ, but still struggle very much in social situations. And then there are two less frequently occurring ASDs, Rett syndrome and childhood disintegrative disorder. When I talk about autism, I'm predominantly talking about classic autism, PDD-NOS, and Asperger's. But what all of them share are impairments in the three core autistic domains. The first, as I started to say, was in the social sphere, where individuals with autism and children with autism have great challenges relating socially to their peers and to other people. They show less of an interest in people than typically developing children, more of an interest in objects than in people. The way we see this in younger children is a lack of joint attention in that they're not showing interest in what other people are interested in. They don't bring objects to show you to indicate that they are interested in them. And also in younger children, we see a lack of imaginative play. The second core feature has to do with communications. We know that most people with autism really struggle to communicate. Many don't speak at all. Some don't stop talking, but again, don't really understand the social cues that work hand in hand with communication and speak about topics that are not of broad interest. And then the third domain is really has to do with behavior. People with autism tend to have very challenging behaviors, including some aggressive behavior, tantrums that far outlast when tantrums should be over, and then what we call the really stereotypic autistic behaviors, hand flapping, toe walking, the tendency to play with toys in unusual ways, like lining them up or organizing them by color or size, rather than playing with toys in the ways that the manufacturer of the toy intended. A few years ago when we talked about autism, we really showed this diagram, sort of a very simple Venn diagram that indicated the overlap of the social, the language, and the behavioral domains. We're now at the point where when we talk about autism, we're really looking at something that's more like this, where we're pulling in many, many more associated syndromes and complexes, including anxiety, sleep issues, seizure disorders, aggression, sensory issues, ADHD, hyperactivity, and other types of impairments that we understand now go hand in hand with the autism diagnosis. So, as Nancy said, I was here at the last conference. It was a wonderful conference. It was great to meet all of you and talk about how we can work together to try to improve vaccine uptake. Last year, we talked about the CASE model, which is a new model for talking with vaccine-hesitant parents. Since then, a lot of work has gone on with the CASE model. I've spoken around the country to different immunization coalition groups who are implementing the model, many of them very successfully. It's really been wonderful to see. And I love getting those emails from providers and clinicians who say, I used the CASE model, and I thought this woman would never get her children vaccinated, but she left and she got her child vaccinated. So that's been great. But there's still so much more work that we need to do. So I just wanted to take a step back and say, what's happened in the year since we last talked about the CASE model and since we last got together? So right before the conference last year, The Lancet retracted Andrew Wakefield's original paper. We've talked about this. The Lancet was the publication that originally published Dr. Wakefield's findings in 1999 that first indicated that there might be a link between MMR vaccine and autism. Last year, The Lancet retracted that paper. Later that year, Andrew Wakefield was stripped of his medical license in Great Britain, so he can no longer practice medicine there. And then earlier this year, January of 2011, Andrew Wakefield's original report was actually deemed an elaborate fraud. It came to light that he falsified many of his data, obtained data in inappropriate means. That was widely published in the mainstream media. I think everyone has heard of that now. Since the last National Immunization Conference, there have been several more studies that have failed to show a link between autism and vaccines. We've certainly heard more in the media about children who are now contracting vaccine-preventable disease, just as we expected they would as the vaccine rates are declining. We knew that more children would be diagnosed. 2 years ago, we used to say, what is it going to take? Is the child actually going to have to die from a vaccine-preventable disease? Now, in fact, unfortunately, children have died from diseases that we can prevent by vaccines. And also, since the last National Immunization Conference, the Vaccine Court ruled in the autism omnibus hearings. Those are the hearings that are looking at autism whether or not vaccines were the cause of autism in certain cases. The general masters in that case came back with very clear language, overwhelmingly strong language. As a PR professional, you almost never expect to see language of this strength. But we did. So what we heard from the special masters were, this case is not a close case. The overall weight of the evidence is overwhelmingly contrary to the petitioner's causation theories. We heard the general masters publicly admonish some of the witnesses and the clinicians in that case by saying the plaintiffs were, quote, misled by physicians who are guilty of gross medical misjudgment. And then finally, this to me was really a very striking thing for a general master to say, but she said, to conclude that Colton was the test case, was the result of his MMR vaccine, an objective observer would have to emulate Lewis Carroll's White Queen and be able to believe six impossible, pretty much stronger language than I think we anticipated. Okay, so we had all of these things, which if you look at the list together, you would say we are really making progress in terms of trying to put some of these questions to bed. And we should be in a position where we are, where more and more parents are feeling reassured, so starting to send that curve in the other direction. But in fact, in January of this year, a Harris poll came out that showed that 18%, and this was after the elaborate fraud publication, so after the report that Wakefield's study was an elaborate fraud, 18% of Americans said vaccines cause autism, and 30% of Americans said they aren't sure. So that's 48% of Americans polled still have concerns about whether or not autism is caused by vaccines. Now, on the one hand, you want to look at that and say, well, half of them are convinced, but 48% still means that we have a lot of work to do. And so we've really been thinking of it. Given all of the data, given all of the studies, given the elaborate fraud, given the result of the special masters, what is it that we have to do? What steps can we take? And we realized that given all of the facts that we have, it's really a communications challenge, that this has to be fought in the media as well as in the clinician's office. So one thing we continue to see, I think, that is still fueling this is Oprah Winfrey continues to feature non-evidence-based cures for a wide range of disease, not only autism, but she continues on her show to entertain these non-evidence-based treatments. This is her last year, so I think some of us said, well, this will be finished, but lo and behold, there's always someone there to pick up the slack, Dr. Oz. Dr. Oz, I think as many of you saw a few in February, basically woke up and realized that autism was affecting 1 in 110 children, said he wanted to do a show about autism and how what we can learn about early intervention. In fact, it became a show about vaccines and whether or not vaccines cause autism. I just want to say this photo was taken before the show. On that show, and I was very proud to sit next to Dr. Ari Brown from the American Academy of Pediatrics on that show. Last year, in fact, at this conference, I presented with Ari. We were since dubbed the Ari and Ali Show. But I'm sorry she's not here today. But basically, the outcome of this show was that this is a raging debate about which there is not enough factual information. Dr. Oz said it is fine to delay the vaccine schedule because we don't know for sure whether vaccines cause autism. And he continued to put forth the theory that there are two sides to this story and that more information. He scared the daylights out of people. I called some people who are not in this world, who don't live and breathe this every day, who I asked to watch the show, and I said, what did you think? And they said, I think vaccines cause autism. I think they might. So this was really, in my opinion, a big setback. The other issue with Dr. Oz, and to me, this is the photograph that truly captures what happened on this show. What you're seeing here, these are six pediatricians that Dr. Oz invited to participate in the show. What he asked them to do was he asked them to raise their hand if they don't think vaccines cause autism. Because, of course, that's how we do science. We vote. So, you know, I think he thought he was hosting American Idol at the time, where we vote for the facts. But he asked them to vote. So as you see in this slide, five of the pediatricians invited said, no, vaccines don't cause autism. There's one pediatrician who's sort of sitting, I'm not sure how you're seeing it, but he's on the bottom closest to Dr. Oz. And he didn't raise his hand, indicating that he thinks vaccines do cause autism. So what does Dr. Oz do? Does he go with the majority? Does he follow up with one of the five who said no, vaccines don't? He rushes over to the one pediatrician who said, yes, I think vaccines cause autism, and says, tell me why you think that. So it was clear to me at that point that he was really not interested in getting out factual material. He was interested in continuing to fuel this controversy because it makes for good television. One thing we are seeing is we are hearing less and less from Jenny McCarthy, who had been the main celebrity spokesperson for the vaccines cause autism hypothesis. She's now really been relegated to the comics section of the newspaper. We often said she should have been in science fiction, But now she's in the comics. And basically, I don't know if you can read this, but this is a Doonesbury comic where they're basically saying, you'd expect better from a playmate. We're not all public menaces. A little harsh. Okay. So, given all of this, given that despite the science and despite everything we've learned, there's these continuing fueling by the media of this as a controversy, because that's what sells ads. As I said, we still have much more work to do in terms of communicating science. Last year at this conference, we unveiled the CASE framework for communicating science with vaccine hesitant parents. CASE is an acronym, C-A-S-E, because all frameworks must have acronyms. I'm married to a management consultant, and he agrees all frameworks must have acronyms. So we stuffed it into one. The first one, C, is for corroborate. And I'm just going to review these quickly because we went through this last year. But I think, much like we heard before from Dr. Marcuse, the first step has to be to acknowledge the parents' concerns and legitimize that they might have a cause for concern, understand why they're concerned, and find some point, and this is the key, find some point on which you can agree, because this sets the tone for a respectful, successful talk. And we talked last year about some specific communication starters that you can use to open the dialogue so that we're starting out on a tone of mutual respect. I think everyone's first inclination is always to rush to the science. When someone says, oh, I don't want my child to have the MMR because it causes autism, our first thought is to say, no, there are 14 studies showing MMR doesn't cause autism, and that was the guy who presented it was stripped of his license, and they retracted it, and here's the science. Immediately, that leads to a parent-child type of conversation. We want to slow down, set groundwork by finding this really statement of empathy or statement of corroboration. The second step for the A in CASE is to talk a little bit about you. Describe what you have done to build your knowledge base and expertise about this issue, particularly about autism. Again, because what that communicates to the parents is this is an issue that you take seriously. This is a legitimate cause for a conversation and cause for concern. And then the third step is to get into the science. And then the fourth step really should be advise, but then it would be the CASA model. So we made it explain, which is then when you give your advice to the patient based on the science, explaining to them why it's so critical for them to vaccinate their child. So I'm just going to go through one example. Last year we went through many more, and many of these examples are now posted online at our website, at the California Immunization Coalition website, at the Texas Immunization Coalition website, Every Child by Two. So you have access to this information. But basically, we'll do one, which is the most common. I heard on TV that vaccines cause autism. It used to be I heard on Oprah. Now it's I heard on Dr. Oz. So here's a statement of corroboration. There's certainly been a lot of coverage on television about vaccines and autism, so I can understand why you might have questions. There certainly has been a lot of coverage. Or another type of statement would be, if the concern is kids, I don't want my kids to get so many vaccines, we could say something like, well, kids certainly do get more shots today than they did back in the 80s. You know, some statement that we can all agree is true, some fact-based statement. Then the second step is to talk about you. I always want to make sure I'm up to date on the latest information about vaccines and autism because I always want to do what's best for my patients. I've researched this topic thoroughly, and those of you who are sitting in this room today can say, in fact, I just returned from a professional conference where we talked about just these issues. Then the third step is to get into the science, and we'll talk a little bit more about the four key points in autism science in just a moment. But this is where you can get into the scientific evidence does not support a causal link. We have study after study after study. All of the major medical organizations in the United States and around the world have reviewed the data. They've all reached the same conclusion. Dozens of studies have been done, and none show a link. The next step here, where it says, in fact, the latest autism science indicates, we've just added that. We really think that that is a key piece in the conversation now, because I think what we're hearing back from parents, even going through this model, is that unless you can answer the question for them about what does cause autism, they will never be satisfied with the answer, well, vaccines don't cause it. It's very hard to say, we know vaccines don't cause it, but we don't know what does cause it. So that's where it becomes really critical for everyone who's involved in the vaccine community to have what I call an autism 101 level of knowledge, really an entry-level amount of knowledge about what is going on, what is the cutting-edge autism research, so that you can share that information with your families. We are learning more every day about what the causes of autism are. And so that's something that I think will help in this conversation. And then the fourth step is to give your advice. Explain what you are asking them to do. Vaccines are critical to maintaining health and well-being. They prevent diseases that cause real harm. We're seeing children now in California and Minnesota who are dying of vaccine-preventable disease. And then, we added this last sentence here in response to feedback, which is that the clinicians should share their personal experience if they feel comfortable. My children are fully vaccinated. I'm not asking you to take any risk with your child that I have not taken with my own. Okay, so in the third step is the science, which is describing what the science says about autism. So I have just four bullets. I don't want anyone to feel overwhelmed with the autism research, so we really broke it down into one key storyline and then one that I think is directly relatable to vaccines. But the first thing is that based on the genetics work that we've been investing in over the last 10 years, we're now able, we found genes responsible for 15% of the causes of autism. So about 5% of that is Fragile X. We have other genes that we've discovered, the SHANK3 gene, 22q deletion, 15q deletion. I won't make you crazy, but we now have enough genes that we can say 15% of children have a definable genetic anomaly, a duplication or a deletion in their genetic code that is responsible for their autism. We're starting to call these the genetically defined autisms. And as more and more of the genetics work comes online and is published, we will find more and more of the genes that are responsible for autism in more and more of our children. What we are learning about these genes is based on the genes and based on the imaging work that we're doing with MRI and functional MRI, we are learning that all of these genes and all of the structural anomalies relate to neural synapses. So I'm sure most of you remember neural synapses are the spaces between neurons. It's the space over which the neurons communicate. There's a lot of neurotransmitters are passed from one neuron to another through the neural synapse. What we're seeing is that autism is most likely a function of these neural synapses, or a pathology of these neural synapses. And so we're starting to actually hear people referring to autism as synaptopathy, indicating, again, that it's this synaptic pathology. And more and more of the imaging studies, the genetic studies, and the other studies are converging on either the formation of neural synapses during the prenatal period or the function of neural synapses. Now, what this is doing is we can see, as a result of these gene anomalies, what proteins in the synapses are not there. Is there a downregulation of a certain protein? Is there too much of one protein, not enough of another protein? And we are identifying those proteins, and what this is doing is it's leading to novel therapies. If there's too little of a protein, we can intervene with a compound to upregulate that protein. And what we're seeing, at least in animal models of autism, is that when we make knockout mice who have this specific gene that leads to a downregulation of this specific protein, when we intervene with these targeted compounds to fix the protein levels, the mice recover function. 14-week-old mice who have shown learning disability their entire 14-week life gain the ability to find the cheese in the maze after this compound is restored. Now, mice are not children, but this is extremely hopeful because what this is bringing to our field is what I think more science, less art. In the past, the way we would do some of these medication trials is we would say, well, this worked in schizophrenia, or this worked in bipolar, or maybe it worked in depression. Let's try it. Sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. This is different. This is looking at a targeted mechanism of action that is associated with a protein, that is associated with a gene, where we're going in to make a correction, and we're seeing improvement in the mice. Now, some of these have moved on to human clinical trials. We have a human clinical trial going on right now in Fragile X, and we will be hearing outcome from that clinical trial at the upcoming International Meeting for Autism Research. But the work is extremely promising, and in my opinion, this is really the cutting edge. This is just extremely hopeful work. So that's really one key storyline that you can share with parents, that as we're discovering the genes, we're making animal models of autism, we're intervening with targeted therapeutics, and in the animal models and in the original and in the beginning phase one clinical trials, the therapeutics are showing real promise to improve the lives of children with autism. The second thing that I think is very valuable for this group to be able to share with patients is that we are able to make the diagnosis of autism earlier and earlier. We used to not be able to diagnose autism until the children were 3 years old. With new studies, we're now able to diagnose children very reliably at 8 months, in some clinics 6 months, and we're going to be hearing soon at 2 months. And that this is a reliable diagnosis, where children who are diagnosed when they're 2 months of age are the ones who go on to have that diagnosis when they're 3 years old. So what this really says is that the children are showing signs and symptoms of autism before they're receiving their vaccinations. Our organization is a CDC partner, so I always talk about the early warning signs of autism. This is a great program put together by the CDC, the Learn the Signs, Act Early. It's really helped an incredible number of parents to become aware of the early warning signs of autism. Early intervention is still the best weapon we have against autism, so everyone needs to know the signs. But babies should be babbling or cooing by the time they're 12 months old. If a child is not gesturing or pointing by the time they're a year old, that is a red flag for autism. And by pointing, I think we really have to emphasize that it's pointing in an effort to draw an adult's attention to something that is interesting to the child. And when my daughter was about 12 months old, my pediatrician said, "Does she point?" And I said, "Well, yeah, she points." But basically what she did is she went around all day making the pointing motion on objects. But really what we have to ask is, does the child point in an effort to draw your attention to something that they're interested in? Babies should respond to their name by the time they're a year old. We hear all the time from our families, "I thought my child was deaf because I would call him, and he never responded. But when I put on the Barney video, he would come running from the other room." So we know that they're not deaf, but children need to respond to their name. Children should say single words by the time they're 16 months old, and they should have two-word phrases by the time that they're 2 years old. And these need to be novel utterances. They can't be repeating sentences or phrases that the children heard in a video or from a book that you've read to them. This, again, tripped us up with my pediatrician, where he said, "Does she have two-word phrases?" And I said, "She has full sentences." But what she had was she would recite lines from the Madeline book all day, full lines, the whole book, beginning to end. So I said, "Sure, she has full sentences." But they need to be novel utterances. What the two-year-old child is saying really needs to be socially relevant to the conversation. And then anytime any child has a loss of language or social skills at any age, that's also a warning sign. So if you see any warning signs in patients or in any children, really they should be referred for evaluation. Doesn't necessarily mean they have autism, but could certainly benefit from an evaluation. Again, I think because it's so critical in your conversations with parents that you keep up with the latest autism research, you know, not the ton of it, just some, so you can have the conversation. Some great resources are the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee Annual Strategic Plan. The 2011 strategic plan was just put online. It'll be, I think it went online at the end of January. It has a great summary of the autism research that took place in 2010. And then in addition, the IAC puts out an annual report called the Summary of Advances. What you see up there is the 2009. The 2010 summary will come out on April 11th. And that has the 20 most critical advances in the field of autism research in, for that year. So again, and also a summary. So it's a great place to just, if you know you're going to have a conversation and your patient is concerned about autism, these are great websites and resources to go to brush up on what is the latest thinking in terms of autism research. We also have a website, I would bear to say a great website, thanks in part to John Crawford, who's here today. But our mission, we're 2 years old. We were founded 2 years ago by parents and scientists working together. Many of the organizations are founded either by parents or their scientific organizations, but this is an issue about which families and scientists both care about and need to work on together. Scientists are parents. You know, many of you here, I'm sure, have children. So the issue that doctors and clinicians and nurses are somehow a different constituency from parents, and in my mind, is false. I think we're all in this together. So basically what Autism Science Foundation does is we support research directly by funding scientists who are doing cutting-edge autism research. We also support families by reinforcing the message that there's no science indicating a causal link between autism and vaccines. And unfortunately, the younger siblings of children with autism are among the least vaccinated in our population. So in addition to being genetically more likely to be diagnosed with autism, our younger siblings are also at great risk for vaccine-preventable disease. And again, as I said, we're founded by scientists and parents working together. We have lots of great online tools and social media tools. Of course, we have a website and a great blog. We're very active on Facebook. Anytime an autism study comes out, if you have questions or your patients have questions about what it means, our Facebook page is always overflowing with conversation. We have a Twitter feed now, and we also have a YouTube channel. What we do on the YouTube channel is we do one-on-one interviews with the scientists who are conducting the research. So as they put out a study, we ask them to describe in layperson's terms, what does this study mean? What does it teach us about cause of autism or treatment of autism? But again, we don't think you need to be have a PhD in neurophysiology to understand, to have a basic level of what is it that we know about what causes autism. So I'm going to leave it there, but I want to say thank you again. I love coming to this conference. I think it's great that we are all working together to solve this problem. I think that the autism community can really be a partner here. I think many, many parents have put this issue behind us. We love our children. We want what's best for them, but we also want to make sure that in addition to having autism, that they don't also contract infectious diseases. So we are your partner here, and if there's anything that we can do, please, please don't hesitate to ask.